What I want to do is create a centering and a balancing inside myself that puts me into a neutral position so that I'm not overly concerned about what I'm going to do next. And the way I describe this sometimes is the way you drive a car. You have to start in neutral. And to drive a good story, you do need to know where neutral is too, because otherwise you use your natural affectations as a personality, and sometimes you aren't making those choices on purpose. For example, what can you tell me about myself as I stand here? Like this. Right. And I haven't said a thing, have I? I mean, in that character, I didn't say anything. It just projects, right? Just by the way I was standing. How about this person? Right. Right. So, if I'm telling a story, I want to create those impressions. Then I deliberately make those choices. But if I don't, I want to be straight so that the story can just flow out, and then you make those impressions in your own mind. And that's kind of the range of choices you can make when you're telling a story. I can control your imagery in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that I do it is by the way I hold myself and the way I use my voice. Another way that I do it is by what I say, of course, and we'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, so I'm going to do my little exercise. I'm putting my feet underneath my shoulders. This is sort of, I call this the basketball, the free-for-all stand. And what's good about it is that you are in good balance so that you can't be thrown off easily. You know, I can stand on one foot or the other after going into that position. And then the next thing I do is breathe, just breathe. This really feels good. Doesn't anybody want to join me? It really feels good. Great, I'm so glad. Just make sure you have a little room in front of you. Push the chairs aside so that you have a little room. And let's use imagery too. Let's use the image of going down a nice gentle slope on skis. That's right, now just swing a little bit. Good. And then just let the breath flow. See, the breath flows naturally. That's one wonderful thing. A lesson in grace. That's good. And then just slow down to a stop. And just continue. Close your eyes and just follow your breath as it flows in. Good. Then raise your arm and continue to breathe deeply. And let your arm reach up until you're reaching so high you can feel your ribs leaving your waist. Just, And let the breath fall in, and as it falls out, just let your arm drop. And then with your next breath out, bring your other arm up. And again, push that finger up in the air until you can feel your ribs lifting. And then on your exhalation, let it gently float down as if your arm were a wing. And now feel your ribs as they are placed. They should feel a little lighter, and there's a space in your back that that may feel like it's a little more open. That's the next one. Make sure you have enough room now so you don't hit your head on anything. Back up a little bit. Is it to inhale again, and watch me first and then do it. As you exhale, just trust the Lord and go over your knees. And really, this is most exhilarating because your blood is now flowing into your head, stimulating your brain cells. And that increases your mental flexibility, just neurologically. Okay? Are we ready? Inhale, and as you hang over your knees, allow your head to drop. If you need to, just touch your chin to your chest and then let your chin fall toward the ground a little. That way you'll know that you're not holding up your head. Those of us who are very responsible tend to do that even when we don't need to. And our heads weigh a lot. That's good. Come on up. You know your head weighs 15 pounds. Some heads weigh more, some less. Okay. Well, you sit down, everybody, and welcome. I guess we could start. My name is Maren Hinderly. I'm a storyteller. And why in the world am I here at Holden Village? Well, I guess you're going to have to decide some of that, but I'm going to start with a story about how I got involved with Holden. I was studying, studying acting in New York City at the American Theater Wing in 1961. And in the summer of 1962, I was given a scholarship, an award, for acting to continue my studies at the Cape Playhouse in Dennis, Massachusetts. Now, in the meantime, I came back to see my parents in Minneapolis. My father was working there at the time, and they were living there. And I was driving home from church in my grandfather's car, and I happened to see somebody that my cousin, who was with me, and I both knew, riding a bicycle along the side of the road. He was riding around the lake, and we decided to take the long way home, go around the lake. He was wearing a Playbach sweatshirt, which we hadn't seen before. And I'm sure it was the sweatshirt that attracted our attention. Anyway, I rapidly found out that I was in a tree. And to give you some idea of my optimistic nature, I decided I'd better get out of the car and see if Judy was okay. So I opened the car door and I lifted up my leg to put it outside the door and walk, and I saw my bone in my knee. So I decided I would wait. And I spent about 3 weeks in the hospital with my cousin Judy, and then the last week was in physical therapy. I arrived not half as badly off as she was, and so I got out a little earlier, and I was sent down to the physical therapy place to start getting my knee back in shape. Of course, the doctor said, well, you're going to have to play old women when you go to the Cape for your summer stock. And I got into the room and I looked around and, oh, how many of you have been in physical therapy? So you know the array of problems that greet you as you walk in the door. I mean, there's just every kind of possible handicap present. And I looked around and my Christian upbringing came to the front, and I thought, oh, these poor, pathetic people. And I looked and I saw this one poor woman with this. She was green and blue, and you know, she had this kind of beak where a nose should be, and you know, she could barely stagger across the floor. And as I got closer to her, I realized I was looking in the mirror. Well, it wasn't very encouraging, but I was determined to get to the Cape and play something besides old women. And if I'd known what I know now, I would have stayed with the old women, because those parts are much more interesting. But I didn't know that then. So I went off finally to the Cape, and in fact I didn't get typecast because I had a stiff knee. And while I was there, I got a letter from my dad saying, should I go up to Holden Village? They want me to be the director up there, and I really don't know if I should go or not. I'm thinking that it's just going to be a thankless task, and I'm going to have to run around all the time, and I'm not even sure anybody wants the place. And it's then he proceeded to tell me, you know, that it was this old mining village up in the mountains above a beautiful lake. It looks something like the fjords of Norway. He could develop the program and also raise the money for it. And they wanted it to be national. And he was hoping that if he did it, he could attract some of his friends from around the country and also in Europe to come as faculty. And I wrote to him and said, I think you were born to live and work for Holden Village. But he didn't particularly listen to me. And it took another year before he was really committed to the place. But then I came out here in 1963 or 64 as part of the religious drama players. From Luther College, Esther Olson had formed this group, and we toured that summer. Holden Village was our final destination. But on the way out, we went for the Lutheran Brotherhood. We did A Cup of Trembling in churches across the country. I don't know, it's possible that some of you may have seen the show. And the Lutheran Brotherhood was sponsoring it, so we were presented by a representative of the Lutheran Brotherhood. I wish I could remember his name. He was a former minister, a wonderful man, as it turned out, because he found out that we were camping. In Bismarck, we slept in a field on a bed of sage. It was wonderful. I loved it. But he thought it was embarrassing. So he made sure that after that we stayed with agents' wives. The agents' wives took care of us. We stayed in their houses. And then they took us out for dinner. It was always before the show, so we could never eat. So we brought big bags, big purses, all of us women in the cast, and we'd pass the bread and put the bread in our purses to eat after the show. I see lots of smiles here. So I think you know that what that kind of situation's like. I think we're gonna have some good stories here tonight. And I'm not gonna go on and on with my life. But I thought you might like to know a little bit about how I got connected to Holden. And I'm here because Elmer Witt is a really smart man, and he asked me to come. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the topic for tonight, or this evening. Storytelling is not a technique. It's a point of view. And as we begin this journey of telling our stories, I want you to consider very seriously who you are and why you are attracted to certain things, perhaps particularly certain stories, because that is your key to what is the cornerstone of your power as a communicator. each of us has certain concerns and certain issues that are dear to our hearts. And as we mature, we are given the gift of knowing more about what that means in more richness and complexity, which is why the older we get, the better our stories become. Stories are the makers and the shapers of culture. Holden Village has a very rich culture. Each of you who comes here returns home with stories that are part of the Holden Village culture. Each of you who come here brings stories that become part of the Holden Village culture. This is true in any community that you belong to. It's also true within the community of your life, the kind of personal identity that is a series of stories about yourself. Muriel Rukeyser is a very interesting poet, but the favorite thing that she's ever said, as far as I'm concerned, is that the world is not made of atoms. It's made of stories. And as an actress, I can assure you that after 20 years of studying human motivation, I know we are motivated not by facts, but by fantasy. It is the story that brings us to Holden, and it is the story that has made you who you are and do the things you do, the way you do them. So it's very important that we all consider, before we go any further with storytelling, that we consider what we really care about. What is our key concern? Now, it's not essential that you come to the answer. In fact, it's better if you contain that as a question and gather possible answers as you go along, because stories will inform you as you tell them. Now, this is an example of how it happened to me. I'd been telling stories since 1965 and 1980. Let's see how many. What's my arithmetic's bad, but anyway, it's about 1980. I was driving down to a festival with another storytelling friend, and she's very interested in dreams. And I told her about one of the most fascinating dreams I'd ever had, which was when I was, I think I was 18. And I had my end of the world dream. Anybody here had an end of the world dream? I bet you have, you just don't know it. The thing that startled me the most about the end of the world dream was that it was so beautiful. I was captivated with the wonder of it all. There were some very shocking events. I was walking home from school, and all of a sudden all the leaves and all the trees started falling off. But they were not like they normally are, dried and shriveled. They were open and they were colored, every color in the rainbow, like flowers. And the aroma was almost intoxicating. When I got to my parents' house, which has a big linden tree out in front, I saw that it too was dying. And so many leaves had fallen off the linden tree that they were piled up to my neck, and I had to come like this to get to the front door. And when I got to the front door and opened it, I walked inside. No one was there. Empty rooms. So I went next door to my neighbors. But my neighbors were not the Arnesons in their Tudor house. It was a Japanese family in a Japanese style home. And I walked in the door And again, there was no sound, and I went from room to room, and when I entered the bathroom, I saw that they had all Roman style in their Japanese bath cut their wrists. And I was shocked, and I ran outside, and I wanted to call to somebody, and I looked out, and there, way across the lake, my parents live on a lake, about a block away from a lake, and on the other side, a gigantic horse was being ridden by my brother, Johann. And it was being ridden, he was riding it like Paul Revere, you know, and leaping from one house to the next. And then I woke up. And I said to Elaine, what does this mean? This is a strange dream. And she said, well, I don't know everything about the dream, she said, but I think that it's the kind of dream people have when they are passing from one life to another. That is to say, I was 18 and I was getting ready to leave home. And it was my departure dream. And I said, well, what about this enormous horse? She said, oh, horses are very important in dreams. She said, you know, the fountain of the Hippocrates is the horse fountain in Greek mythology, which Apollo had Pegasus create when he went down to inform the Muses that they weren't going to be in charge of the arts anymore, that he was taking over. And so Pegasus, the winged horse, pawed the ground with his hoof. And where he pawed the ground, a fountain sprang up. This fountain was the fountain of refreshment and restoration for all of the artists. It was the poet's fountain, and they would come there to refresh themselves, just as we are here to refresh ourselves. I said, I love that story. There are so many stories about horses, and girls are known to be somewhat horse crazy, but what about those of us who are no longer girls, but still in the gender? Why don't we do a show about horses? She thought that was wonderful. So we invited two other friends, other storytellers, to work on the show. We created a ritual to warm up for our practices. Each of us was going to do a different horse story. We went horseback riding together to develop our ensemble and our bonding and our imagery. And then, one day as we were practicing, Holly, who was the youngest of the four of us and a beautiful violinist, said, you know, it's very interesting. Each of us has chosen a distinctly different story to tell. And as we mused over it, we realized that that was so. Holly, the youngest, had chosen creation myths. She was young and wanted children. Elaine, the dream therapist, was fascinated with transformations. And her story was an Indian myth of transformation. And Sarah, who memorized the scriptures and told them in churches, sort of the way the Gospel according to Mark was done, if you saw that, she was telling something from the four horses of the apocalypse. And her fascination was with Revelation. Yeah. And then I'm not going to tell you what they said. My key concern was, but I will tell you the story that I told that night. Somebody asked me, what does once upon a time mean? And I said, it's a convention. which it is, it's also a door. There are other conventions that are used as doors. When we begin to tell a story, we're doing it by agreement because we're co-creators of the event. You, the listener, are creating the story as I tell it to you. And I'm getting key impressions from the way you listen that shape the way I'm going to tell the story. So that's what makes it so exciting. It's never the same. And in Haiti, to get permission, the storyteller will say, "Crick," and he'll wait until the audience says, "Crack." Crick?
Crack.
Once upon a time, there was a girl who was horse crazy. Nobody in her mining town seemed to mind, although they all knew about it, because they were minding about the mine closing. But one day her mother came to and said to her father, "You know that girl, she's always out with the horses, and I need her around to help with the chores." "Huh," said her father. "That's no good, no good at all. Why, she's a young lady now. It's time she started thinking about other things. I'll talk to her." "Young lady, you're spending too much time with the horses. Your mother needs your help at the house. Besides, you're an attractive young woman now. There are young men that would be interested in you. But who wants to talk to a girl who smells like a horse? You let me and your brothers do the work on the horses. That's men's work anyway." "But father, it's not work to me. I love to be with the horses." Well, she did help her mother out, but she spent all her spare time with the horses. She loved to curry them down. She knew the grasses that they loved to eat the most, and she'd take them out into the fields and up the mountainsides. And then when they were sick, she was the one who knew it first and got help. And then one day, she was out in a field while they were grazing, and she fell asleep. It was quite a hot summer day, sort of the way it is here. And the sky grew green like it gets before a storm on the plains. And the air was heavy with the seas of thunder and lightning. And then it broke. Was raging overhead, and she was sleeping below with the horses stirring uneasily in the field, until at last a thunderclap broke over her head and she woke and jumped onto the back of one of her horses and rode with the wild horses raging in front of the wind. They were driven by the storm like a brown flood, up one slope and down another, until at last the storm exhausted retired, and they dropped to the ground, and she saw they were under the stars with strange hills in a strange valley. They were lost. She fell asleep. And in the morning she woke to look right into the face of the most beautiful wild stallion she'd ever seen in her whole life. And he was shaking his mane, pawing the ground with his hoof. And he said, "Come with me, ride with me and my wild horses." So she jumped onto the back of one of her horses and they all took off up over the hills with the stallion and his wild herd. Happy to be free at last. Back in town, the people looked for her day after day. And finally they gave up. About a year later, some hunters from town were up in the mountains and they saw across the valley a stallion and riding on a beautiful mare beside him was a young girl. They took off after them, and they got close enough to almost capture her. But the stallion circled her and her mare and pawed the ground with his hoof until sparks flew and his eyes shone like stars. They couldn't help but admire his spirit. And she would have escaped with the stallion if it hadn't been for the mare who stumbled and fell. They took her back to the village, and she was happy to see her family again. Everyone said, now she'll settle down and get married and live like the rest of us. But she grew sick. She was so ill, she couldn't get out of bed. Her parents called in one doctor after another, and all the specialists consulted. And every night, as the sun went down, you could hear the stallion calling to her from a bluff outside of town. Finally, one of the experts said, well, maybe we should ask her. So they did. And she said, well, I know I was happy when I was riding with the wild horses. Maybe if I could ride with the wild horses again, I'd get well. Her parents loved her, so they knew they had to let her go. And they decided to have a marvelous celebration. They invited everyone in town, and they had food and drink and music, and they brought out the blankets they'd made for the horses and gave them to the wild stallion when he came into town with his herd. And then they braided their tails and their manes and decorated them with feathers and beads. And the stallion brought a colt as a gift to her parents. And then she got on the back of one of the wild horses and rode off with the stallion. But year after year, she'd return to visit her family. And each time she came back, she brought a colt as a gift for her parents. Then, one year, she didn't return. And shortly after that, the hunters were up in the mountains again, and they saw the wild stallion running, galloping across the valley with a beautiful mare by his side. And they said, she's joined the horse people. And all the people rejoiced. Well, now, in the Indian tradition, or in one of them, I should say, there's a saying, it goes like this, bow, bow bended, my story's ended. If you don't like it, you may mend it. The oral tradition means you take this story, and if you love it, you go ahead and you tell it. And it will be different because it will be told with your point of view. Now, we're talking about finding and telling our own stories, and you might say, well, the girl who loved wild horses, I mean, that's not your own story, is it? It is my story. Any story you tell that you endow with your faith and the way you look at things is your story. And that's why I think it's so important that we consider telling stories from the Bible. There's a book at the bookstore that I recommend to you. It's called The Bible, A Child's Playground, and I just discovered it this year. It's sort of hermeneutics for for young people. And I think it's an excellent discussion of the issues involved with telling the stories rather than reciting them from the Bible. It's risky. I'm not saying you won't have problems. There'll be controversy. I mean, there's a lot of controversial issues in the Bible that we aren't sure children should hear, or some people might not like to think of children hearing. And in fact, there are some stories in there that maybe we would just as soon adults didn't hear it either. But I recommend it, and I like to talk, if you want to discuss that in a little bit, we can. Right now, I'd like to continue with this exploration, the journey, by giving you the next step to discovering your point of view, which is going to be a guided fantasy or imagery. And some of you may have already taken something like this, so if you have, you'll be flying free and easy, and if you haven't, you will too, because all you have to do is just close your eyes and relax. And remember how we were going through my warm-ups at the beginning and breathing in and out? Well, that's what I want you to do now too. Only this time, as you breathe in, color the breath. Give it a cool color. And as it goes out, give it a warm color. Now with your mind's eye, follow your cool colored breath as it flows in and down through your body. Send it all the way to your toes. And then let the warm air rise. Now as the cool air flows down through your body and the warm air rises up, it flows in and out just like a wave on water. And the easy flow of the breath is where your mind and rest. Set aside all other thoughts, cares, for the time being. They'll be there when you return. And just let yourself rest on this easy flow of the breath. Now as the breath flows down to your toes, a cool shower of relaxation flows through every inch of your body. And the warm air rises, taking all the tensions, all the pains with it. And you're floating easily with your breath. And as the cool air flows and the warm air rises, they join to carry you floating easily, floating higher, rising above the floor, and now rising beyond the building, Koinonia, and higher, above the village and into the blue sky of the mountain air. And as you float into the blue, it becomes deeper and deeper and deeper. And you are carried by your breath toward a point of light at the far end of this warm, dark tunnel. And as you reach that light, it opens up and you hear a voice of someone you love very much
And that voice says, welcome and look well, for here you will find the memory that blesses you. And as you look, you see scenes from your life passing. And you come closer to one picture. And as you move toward the picture, you find you are walking right into it. And everything is as it once was. And there you stay. Until you hear the voice again. Look well, for there is something here that you are given, something you love. When you find it, take it and bring it back with you. And sure enough, as the scene unrolls, you see something that is very dear and precious to you. So you take it and hold it in your hands. And as you're holding it, you find yourself once more carried by your breath. And you are floating easily and gently back through the warm, dark tunnel. And now you are floating high in the blue mountain air and gently descending down toward the village. And here you are at last seated in your chair. And as you breathe out, bring your hands to your face. And with your next exhalation, open your eyes and look into the palms of your hands. And then focus on the room between your fingers. And then with your next exhalation, stretch your arms as high as you can and point the energy to the ceiling. And next exhalation, bring your arms down. Welcome back. I'm glad nobody fell asleep, especially Elmer. He's the only one who has permission because he probably gets about 3 hours a night. Yesterday was his day of rest, ironically. Now, what did we bring back from our trip that we'd like to talk about? We've got plenty of time. How long do you think that took us? Don't cheat and look at your watch. No, it's a little longer than that. What did you say?
10.
Not that long. It was about 5 minutes. But when you're telling stories, you enter a different time zone. And we'll talk about that at a different session and deal with that at a different session, how endings and beginnings come together with the storytelling process. There's one other intellectual point that I'll make before we start going around sharing our treasures. A psychologist from Loyola University has done some research on the role, on the personality that is power motivated, the personality that is intimacy motivated, and the personality that is generative, meaning the personality that wants both intimacy and power. And that person is the kind of person that wants to synthesize
their experiences into a creative act that they let go. And that's what telling stories involves, or singing, or making a picture, or building something, or fixing a machine, or any creative act that you do, preaching a sermon, or name it. I mean, you can name many things like that. So we're going to engage in a generative activity now. Would you like to start?
I'm an objective realist with a losing sense of humor.
Oh, great. So something funny happened to you.
No, it did. I didn't go.
So what happened instead?
I was watching all of you.
Uh-huh. And what did you see?
Well, I thought I would see someone go to sleep, but they didn't. So I guess I saw those who didn't go to sleep.
And now you're going to find out why they didn't.
Hope so.
Okay. Do you want to go next?
I suppose it was kind of a peaceful solitude and viewing a beautiful experience of holding that goes back for quite a period of time. So I was kind of looking back and thinking of the times that we've looking over this whole, I just up somewhere there, looking down at this great spot. I was kind of drifting a lot.
Did you have any sensory impressions? Like, were you warm or cold? Or did you smell anything?
I didn't smell anything.
Did you, what about the voice? Could you identify the voice that you heard?
No. I think I was listening more to yours and maybe some other one. I don't think I'd be parted so much from that, from the reality of my own situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you feel when you came back?
I think I'm, at the end of a fairly long day, so I was quite
tired.
Quite relaxed.
Relaxed.
Quite relaxed. We did some, I had done that already once today, and some relaxation exercises. In fact, it faded out. I had a nice session this afternoon, so I think it was kind of a trip rather than that. But I did move into the kind of my own holding life or experience. It was quite comfortable, quite peaceful. There weren't any things that were pretty near.
What happened to you, Paula? Did you find anything?
Yes, in the fact that I relived a short time experience of it was a parting at an airport of someone who's very dear to me who I haven't seen since and I will not know when I will see again, and a promise that was made between us as they left of savoring it.
Uh-huh.
Just enjoying it, and in reliving it, restates it and makes it fresh again. And adds a little fuel to the fire and a little vitality to a reason for going on.
Good. Anybody else want to share what they found? Yeah, good.
Can you mention the humor? I was doing pretty good until I got up in the sky park, and I was just about falling asleep, and I had to keep thinking, no, I can't fall asleep, I have to stay with you. But when I got up there, you said something about, and you get up there, and you're, somebody says something to you, I don't remember what you said. So anyway,
yeah, so you find something that you want to keep.
Okay, but I remember, and I was going to, I thought it would be really funny at this time if I said to my husband, I'm here, or something like that, thinking you were the one I was thinking about when I got up there. And so that kind of blew it, because I spent my whole time thinking that it would be funny if I said that now, you know? So there was a bit of humor.
Good, good. That's good. Did anybody feel irritated? Sometimes people do. They feel really kind of aggravated. It's sort of like, ooh, it's not the four walls that I'm used to, you know? It's a different orientation, it's another culture. I mean, haven't we had enough of that? That kind of feeling. Yeah.
Well, not to be strange or too far out, but kind of an out-of-body experience. Just soaring up again, up above where we are, and going back to my childhood and finding the things that were so important to me then.
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad.
It wasn't a sad experience.
Uh-huh.
Just a touching one.
I'm so glad. I was hoping that we'd find some things like this. Does anybody want to be a little more specific about what they found? Yes, good.
I was really struck by coming to choices in images and then kind of choosing one and not knowing why. And where it led me was back to the backyard of the house that I grew up in when I was about 10 years old. And I was walking around in the backyard and seeing the big pile of junk and the old rabbit hutches and all those other things. And there was an excavation. And I remember very clearly as a kid playing Cowboys and Indians in the excavation. And I picked up this old toy six-shooter. And I kept saying to because I was hearing you say, find a treasure. And I kept saying, well, that's a dumb treasure. And I kept looking around. There must be some of this special thing around here. And I couldn't find it. Every time I started to look for something else, I kept coming back to the six gun. And then I decided, well, that's the treasure. And then that's what I brought back.
That's a wonderful story. It's almost a metaphor for the story of Holden Village. I was reading the history of it in the Surprising Gift book, and almost the same process exactly. I mean, people were saying, "Ugh, we don't want that," and then they'd look again, and well, maybe we do want it. And then again, and Gil Berg was the first manager of the village was sleeping in Chalet 1, and he said that the first night he slept there, he had to throw a shoe at a rat that was running over his feet. I mean, this is what this beautiful place used to be like. The first work crew replaced 8,000 windows from vandals. Washed 9,100 of them. I mean, that's a wonderful story. Keep that story going, because that could be applied to a lot of kinds of situations. Good one. Anybody else want to be a little more specific?
I kind of felt like when they were floating up, I kind of just pictured someone floating up on, like, the mountains. I just pictured a mountain landscape.
Uh-huh.
Just all across.
Mm. So did you feel like you were flying?
Yeah, I felt like I was just kind of floating up, and that, you know, nothing mattered. And that just, you know, I pictured a really beautiful countryside.
Yeah. It's a great release. Wasn't that, did you feel free, kind of free? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Thanks for sharing that.
I had a hard time getting with your program, but once I did, I remember very little about what you said. But I can remember sitting here with my eyes closed and you talking about going down a dark tunnel and seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and I was with you in that dark tunnel, railroad tunnel,
mm-hmm.
for some reason, on Gorge Highway, undoubtedly. Mm. And following that, and following it, and following it, and seeing the light become bigger, and there was a meadow, tree line, not a lot of trees, but a tree line. And then I remember you saying, find something you love. My wife was there.
I was there too.
Oh, yeah. This is wonderful.
You're my wife. And then you said, grab a treasure. So I took her hand and started walking back down the tunnel. And then I woke up like this, and I'm not sure why I woke up like that.
Oh, good. You did. Oh, I did.
I'm not sure
why
I was like this, other than the strobe effect or something. I don't know.
No, the reason that I like to end my imagery in this place, because it's an introverted focus first, then it's a gradually, you gradually focus out. So
I didn't focus on my hands. Focus, the hands were a blur.
Ah.
So I was out already, I guess.
Uh-huh. So you just came out a little faster, that's all. This kind of dreaming, this sort of imagining, is the kind of process that makes... Is it seven? Oh, my watch is slow. Okay, well, I've got 3 minutes to finish. That's all I need. Is the kind of process that creates interesting stories. And the other point is that you all had much more interesting images than I had directions. Because we all of us have the capacity to make rich images in our brains very, very fast. And telling stories is a way of enjoying that part of ourselves so that we can find our own story in the story that's being told to us. So those are the two things to remember about telling your stories. Use your own images and let other people create theirs. You don't have to be real specific when you're telling a story, because the listener will fill in a lot of the details. Well, thanks a lot. If you have any other questions you want to ask me, feel free to buttonhole me now or later, anytime.